matter what you get over that radio, over that telephone, you may get there. And I know we went to a lady's house one time to a little smoke call, and she had been burning some kind of little scented candles in her house. And one of them had caught fire on the stove or something, and we carried it outside. And this thing was no bigger than, not much bigger than your thumb. And we just dumped a little water extinguisher on it and blew it. This big ball of fire just leapt out and singed her eyebrows. And we said, what is this stuff? We put some halon on it. It didn't even phase it.
What was it?
We don't know what it was. The chief finally sent it off and got it analyzed. The only way we could put it out was to completely get it in an airtight container. That's all, I don't know what the stuff was, but it was bad news, whatever it was.
My goodness. Firefighter turned writer Larry Brown. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about his most recent book, a memoir entitled On Fire, a personal account of life and death and choices. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Following my conversation with Larry Brown, physicist Arthur Zients will be here this week to talk about his new book, Catching the Light, The Entwined History of Light and Mind. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Before he turned full-time to writing novels, short stories, and plays, Larry Brown worked for 17 years in the Oxford, Mississippi Fire Department. His new book recalls that experience. On Fire, a personal account of life and death and choices, describes Larry Brown's daily encounters with violence, death, and moments of courage. I asked him to tell how he became a firefighter.
Well, I just kind of looked into it. I was working in a stove factory in 1973, I believe it was, about a year after I'd gotten out of the Marine Corps. And an opening came available, and I applied for it. And the first time I went, the chief wouldn't hire me because my hair was too long. And
so, well, they called you Bush, didn't they?
They called me Bush back then. And so I went and got a haircut and was driving my forklift in the warehouse one day a couple of months later, and the chief stopped by in his car, and he said, "You still interested in the job?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I sure am." And he said, "Well, come up to the station and talk to me one day." So I did, and he hired me.
Larry, did you have any idea back then, those many years ago, that there would be a connection between these two apparently completely different worlds, the world of the writer and the world of the firefighter?
No, back when I got that job, I figured I would be there 30 years. I never figured I'd do anything else. I thought that was the way it would be, and I didn't write anything until 7 years later. It was really completely unexpected the way it happened.
Uh-huh. You say, Larry Brown, that a firefighter is always in training. You're always practicing. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether it's an explicit sort of physical activity or whether it's mm-hmm. completely mental. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the trip to put out the Christmas tree. You guys are leaving this swath of beer cans as you travel in Mississippi. How about it?
Yeah, and I think that was probably the first time that I had ever faced one of those Christmas trees. That's why they call it a Christmas tree, just because of the shape of the pipes. But what it is, this framework of pipes is hooked to a gas truck, you know, that's pumping, I don't know how many gallons a minute or whatever, enough to create a ball of fire about 20 feet high. That's about 1,500 degrees, and you can feel that heat from 50 feet back, and you've got to go right up to it with that hose and just push with two hoses and push the flames back so that the two streams of water mesh and keep the fire at bay long enough for somebody to get down on his knees and go up and shut the valve off. And it's a terrifying thing, but if you do it right, nobody will get hurt.
Now, this where your jacket, your fireman's uniform almost melted on you there?
No, that was a different thing there. That was the day I got stuck between the house and the tank when my coat melted off. Mm. But now I've seen other people get their face shields melted, their helmets melted, and all this kind of stuff just from being too close to a fire.
Larry, being a firefighter, does that make you eventually callous, indifferent to human suffering, to strike a serious note here in this book?
I don't think it makes you callous. I think what you have to do when you're working a wreck is try to forget about what's going on with the person, because you know If they're lucky, they're in shock because that shock takes over and stops you from feeling a lot of the pain that you normally would be feeling. It kind of prevents your nerve endings and all from working. And I think to do your most efficient job, you cannot concentrate on a person's pain, but you can concentrate on how to quickly and correctly get that car from around that person. That's your only job, is to get that person out of that car as fastly and as safely as you can, and to sustain, if they have any life-threatening injuries, to sustain them. Now, usually you'll have the EMTs there to do that for you, and your only job is just to remove the car from around the victim.
Do you lose your sense of sympathy for human suffering? Tell me about that.
No. I've seen people that we took out of cars just be screaming and hollering, "Y'all guys, y'all are killing me, y'all are killing me." But there's nothing we can do any better than what we do. I mean, if they've got, you know, broken bones or head injuries or cuts or whatever, there's nothing we can really do to alleviate that except get them into an ambulance as quickly as possible, to get them to the hospital, to get a doctor a hold of them so a doctor can start working on them. That's our primary concern.
What kind of an effect do you want this book to have on people who don't know a lot about fires and firefighting and your life, you know, to use some stark language here, life and death and choices? Mm-hmm. That's what the book is about.
I think I probably just would want for them to come away with a better knowledge of what people who work in emergency services do and the kind of tasks they perform and what it's like, you know, what a day in the life of a firefighter is like, because they have to be prepared for so much, and they have to be in such good physical condition, and they have to give up a lot. But I'd like people to realize what a very rewarding profession it is, and that's the reason I liked it so much, because I always felt like I was helping people on the best days.
Uh-huh.
And on the worst days, I thought I wasn't accomplishing anything.
Have you put it behind you? Is firefighting still a part of your life? In what way?
Well, that's kind of funny. As we're sitting here talking, I keep saying we, us, like I'm still there. And I guess I just consider, I was there for so long, it's hard for me to completely separate myself from it. And anytime I go to any town and see a fire truck, I check it out, and it's something I think just probably gets in your blood and never leaves.
How about the macho angle, Larry? Here, you're about what, 5'7", 5'8"? You're a wiry little guy. You're a real strong guy. Are you proving something to yourself, you know, in recollecting the experience and going into it? Was it a kind of a macho trip?
Well, I think maybe when I started, I probably didn't really have any idea what was going on, and it took some time to get into it, and it didn't take long to find out how scary it was. But certainly it took me a while to realize that what was going to be required to work my way up through the ranks up to captain, which I finally eventually made. But there's so much you got to learn. You don't know anything when you start, and you've got to learn everything about ropes and ladders and hoses and fire extinguishers and the nature of fire, and you have to take all these courses and all these tests. We had to learn all the hydrants, 90% of all the hydrants in our city, to pass a 6-month probation period, and we had 550 plugs. And so you had to make 90% or you got booted out the door.
Now, that sounds like a kind of trivial sort of thing. And yet, in a way, that's what a writer does. You're always taking inventory and figuring out how you're going to talk to yourself about something.
Yeah.
Too much of a stretch?
No, I don't think so. You've got to know where those hydrants are on the way to the house that you're going to, because you're going to have to, if the house is on fire, you're going to have to lay a line, and you're going to have to know where it's a forward lay or a reverse lay, where you're going to catch it going up the street or coming back down the street. And a rider has to learn all these things too. Just in the beginning, little simple things like just how to move characters around in a room and make them behave correctly and speak correctly and think correctly. And it's a real slow process.
Larry, tell me about the movement from the firehouse to Mr. Faulkner's front yard. There's a kind of an unlikely leap, but you make it in this book. How about it?
Yeah, I never had been to his house until I got a call one day from the chief wanting me to go down there and set up what we call a shower curtain for some New Yorkers who were down there shooting a documentary on Faulkner's life and everything. So we went out there, drove the truck right into the driveway, and he's got his own personal fire hydrant right there in your front yard. You know, you got to protect it. That big antebellum mansion there, that big literary landmark. And so while we were down there doing that, was the first time I got to look at Roanoke. And I walked all around, looked at the house, and I thought, wow, this thing's sitting here right in the middle of Oxford. I didn't even know it was here. And it's, you get on his place, it's like you're out in the country, because there are all those big trees and all that land is out there, and you can't see University Avenue and those hamburger joints or any of that kind of stuff. It's like you're just in another place. But
you feel a kinship with this man, do you?
Well, I don't know about how much of a kinship I feel. I like to go out there and walk around, and there's just a real peaceful feeling around that place to me, and it's really nice to just stand there and think about all the stories and the great books that came out of that place, and all the hard work that was done there, and what he built out of his life just with writing.
Is the book finally Larry Brown? The title is On Fire. The subtitle is A Personal Account of Life and Death and Choices. Is it finally affirmative, or is it finally about this very destructive thing that you write about in this book?
Yeah, I think it's affirmative. It's a note of sadness at the end because I left, and you know, I'll probably never be completely reconcile that decision to leave, but there was this other thing that I wanted to do worse that just came along, and it just got to the point where I didn't think I could do both of them anymore at the same time, because I had juggled both of them at that point for 10 years.
How do your buddies and your friends in the fire department, how do they look on you now? Are you one of these weird exotic New York literati types or what?
Nah, they're glad to see me come around. They gave me a ride in their new pumper the other night up to the bookstore in Oxford, and I took a ride in that big old thing. And it'd been 4 years since I'd been inside a fire truck, and it felt good to ride in one. And they had all read the book, and they all liked it. They're all happy with it, and they're all excited because they can find themselves in there.
Larry Brown is the author of two novels and two collections of stories. His new book is a memoir of his firefighting years in Oxford, Mississippi. It's entitled On Fire, A Personal Account of Life and Death and Choices. On Fire is available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. From Fire to Light. In just a moment, Arthur Zients of Amherst College will be here to talk about his new book, Catching the Light, The Entwined History of Light and Mind.
We traverse an enormous span in the natural history of light, both scientific and sacred. Like a jeweler studying a faceted diamond, whose fleeting colors change with the smallest turn, we have held light always before us, rotating it slowly before our eyes. It has taken on 1,000 forms, changing in our hands like the Greek god Proteus. Yet for all that, it is one being still. Paraphrasing Herder, we can say, that which is called light in creation is, in all its forms and in every being, one and the same spirit, a flame unique.
Physicist Arthur Zients of Amherst College. His new book is called Catching the Light, The Entwined History of Light and Mind. This is a book that goes to some fundamental issues in the confluence of science, philosophy, and art, namely the evolution of knowledge and the development of the human mind itself. Here's Arthur Zients.
Light has two sides to her, if you will. One side of light certainly is the side which we know as physicists, which we investigate in the laboratory. But light is a many-faceted thing. Not only is it a physical energy which illuminates our world, but also we sense that light has, for many cultures and in many times, including our own, it's also a metaphor for the spirit, for example.
You talk about the light of nature, and you talk about the light of mind. Does that mean that there is a light that originates inside our heads that responds to this light that comes from outside?
Well, no physical light, obviously, arises within us to respond to the light without. But I think of that inner light, which the Greeks considered to be an actual ocular fire, a fire within the eye.
Right.
And they spoke about it as streaming out into the world in order to allow vision to take place. I think of that as a metaphor which has a great deal of truth within it.
Is that a form of human vanity, that that the human mind lights up the world rather than the other way around, the light from the sun lighting up the world?
Well, you know, the sun itself was considered to be an eye by the ancient Greeks, but also by the ancient Egyptians, the Persians, and so forth. There were two eyes in the heavens. One was the eye of the sun, and the other was the eye of the moon. The two eyes of Horus, they were sometimes called. The Egyptian god Ra, in the Turin Papyrus, there's a wonderful line where he says, "When I openeth mine eye, it is day. When I closeth mine eye, it is night." And the human being likewise, when they open their eyes, it is day. And when they close their eyes, it is night.
Where would the novelists and the poets be without, without that kind of language? Right. Arthur, tell me the stories very quickly, the anecdotes of the 8-year-old boy and the 50-year-old man who learned to see. As odd as that sounds.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
There are many, many case histories of this, and this exemplifies just the nature of these two lights. Failing one or the other, we are blind. And so, for example, a child born congenitively blind can now, and also back already a couple of hundred years ago, be surgically operated on such that they were given back the physical capacity to see.
And yet didn't see.
And yet did not see. That is to say, the inner light had not been kindled within their own visual system inwardly to allow them to see. And there are case histories, the two you refer to are a very touching case history in France of a young child, 8 years old, who's operated on, and when the doctors remove the bandages and wave their hands in front, it's clear from his response that he really sees nothing. He of course sees the movement of a colored swatch in his field of view, but he doesn't know this to be a hand. And so the intelligence that must live in vision is absent. And that is the light, if you will, that inner light that we bring into seeing. Failing that, the world is chaotic, confusing, befuddling. You know, this second case, the case of SB, led to a very difficult life for a patient at 50 who was also in a similar way healed physically of his vision deficiency, but inwardly found it tremendously exhausting to learn to see. It was too complicated. Often he would go about with sunglasses on or leave the lights off in his house. Hmm. It was easier to navigate without the confusion of sight.
What do you mean, for example, you have one chapter in your book, Catching the Light, that is called The Light Divided. Are we talking about, what, a scientific and cultural tussle here of definitions? What was going on?
Well, at a certain point, the inner light is lost track of. The sense that I am an active participant in seeing, that in fact, in the Greek imagination, the dominant theme is the inner light streaming out. But around the 12th, 13th century, there's a dramatic shift. Often one says it's scholastically or historically due to the influence of the Arabic community. But be that as it may, there's a shift away from a marriage of two lights, and really the human being is seen as a passive recipient.
Is this what we call science?
The dawn of the scientific revolution, right.
The beginning of what we now call our secular priesthood.
Exactly, and the beginnings of that go back to that early period, and of course then with Galileo and others, it takes on a robust life of its own. And the eye, as opposed to being a projector of light, becomes a camera obscura, which means simply a darkened chamber.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed then to an ocular fire, we have darkness in the eye.
Are you scientists all basically agreed, therefore, on what light is? Here in the in our modern 1990s, we've got fiber optics and toys and bells and whistles. That's a problem that I take it you put to bed a long time ago.
No, this is one of the great things, that the more I've studied light, the quantum mechanics of light, for example, which is where I do my research, the more subtle light becomes. One can look already in the 19th century when there were great theories, great advances with regards to the nature of light. It had a very particular character.
Huh.
And not only then is that character and understanding of light shaped by the hard facts of science, but I would say also the very kinds of questions we pose reveal the light of intelligence that we bring, if you will, that to open up certain kinds of issues with regards to light. So still in our time, there's a shifting light of intelligence attempting to illuminate the nature of light.
Arthur Zients, we're talking about your book, Catching the Light. What do you mean by ensouling science? Unravel that one for me.
Yeah. If you tell the story of the history of light, which my book does, you find that at a certain point it appears that the heart, the soul, the spirit of light is vanquished. It disappears. And then there are figures, artistic, poetic, spiritual philosophers or what have you, who appear at the dawn of the modern period, in the 19th and early 20th century. Mm-hmm. Individuals like Goethe, Kandinsky, Rudolf Steiner, and others, who begin to weave back in these lost threads, not in a way which harkens back to some ancient form of understanding, but they try very much in a modern way to sing that inner story of light in a way which will be accommodated or can become accommodated with contemporary science.
They want to be human beings, and yet they want to be respectable scientists at the same time.
Yeah, Goethe very much saw himself both as a poet and as a scientist. The work of which he was proudest, he talked to his secretary, and he spoke to his secretary, Eckermann, at the end of his life, was his theory of color, not his Faust.
Arthur Zients, is this to what degree is this a personal sort of mission or journey that this book represents? It's called Catching the Light. Is this a book about spirit, or is it a book about physics?
Well, here again is a dichotomy, which I'd like not to fall into. I think if one reads the works of any great scientist, whether it's Einstein, Heisenberg, Schrödinger, what have you, they would not have fallen into seeing it as either physics or as some kind of aspiration, a spiritual aspiration, which they were engaged in. Scientists are passionate about their enterprise, not because of some logical argument or some kind of paycheck that comes across the table, but because of something that lives within them that is of the nature of spirit.
Does that mean that light is God? Is light our divinity? I'll get real personal with you for a moment. What really are you talking about here?
Light has traditionally been an attribute of God. For myself, it's been a mystery, I'd say. Something which I don't want to label it as anything in particular, and yet I'd love to explore every facet, every aspect, both mythic as well as scientific. And I feel that that is my responsibility, not to label it as either a photon as an excitation of the radiation field, or as the face of God, but rather to engage each of those descriptions, to give them their place, their rightful place, both in my imagination, in my culture's imagination. And I think then we nurture a fuller, a more robust and ecological, if you will, understanding not only of light, but really of anything that could be approached that way. How is it that we know each other as human beings? Not only from one side in the body, but also through conversation, through affection, through suffering, through compassion.
Arthur Zients, your book is Catching the Light. Of all of the dozens of topics and themes and events that you touch on in this account of what you call the entwined history of light and mind, do you have a favorite example, one anecdote that comes to mind?
Perhaps my favorite experience, and this is my own anecdote, if you will, not a historical one, was sitting at dinner with Rusty Schweikert, an Apollo astronaut.
Oh, my goodness.
Who was the first to walk outside a spacecraft without an umbilical. And there he is, hanging out in space, and the camera, which is monitoring him, jams. And he looks out and around him. And I asked him, I said, well, what does space look like?
Right? Oh, my goodness.
Because you're embedded in light many hundreds of times brighter than the light on the Earth. Uh-huh. And so you'd think, there you are, completely surrounded and carried by light. What does all that light look like? And he said, well, if you turn yourself away from the Earth, which is bright, and the spacecraft, which is bright, and you look out into space, and you see light, what you see is absolute darkness.
Does this frighten you as a physicist or enlighten you?
It's just the point of departure. That is the point of wonder, which Plato says is the beginning of all philosophy, beginning of all natural philosophy, beginning of all science. That light itself, something by which we see everything around us, is in of itself invisible. We stand or swim in space, as Rusty Schweikert did, embedded in light, swimming in that light, and yet it is dark. So what is this thing we call light?
Arthur Zients is a professor of physics at Amherst College. His new book is called Catching the Light, The Entwined History of Light and Mind. Catching the Light is available from Bantam Books. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guests this week were novelist Larry Brown and physicist Arthur Zients. Audio tapes of this program are available for $10. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 739. That's program number 739. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code once again, 27709. You can also reach us through email. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ecsvax.uncecs.edu. Next week on Soundings, poet Donna Mazzini. Donna Mazzini will be here to read from and talk about her prize-winning collection of poems, a volume entitled That Kind of Danger. Until then, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.